Thank you, Billy. Thank you, group. It's really nice to be sitting here in an AA meeting right now. My name's Kevin, and I'm an alcoholic. Introduce myself. I love being an alcoholic. I mean, I love it. I can't believe that I'm to a point in my life where I'm saying that, but it's true. You know, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been given a totally new life. I've been reborn. And things have happened in my life that I never could have anticipated. To the fact that I'm sitting here on a Sunday night in my basement, I'm wearing a tie. Billy told me my sponsor wore a tie, so I ran upstairs and put a tie on real quick. I'm never to be outdone. Just to be sitting here looking at, I've got the screen set on gallery view, so I can see all of you. And I love it. It's so, we're, you know, just the fact that we're here right now, says a lot about this program, you know, that we've been brought together and that we're all in the game, you know, working towards a better life instead of that madness that I used to live in, you know. And when I say I'm an alcoholic, it's significant for me. It means a lot because I used to go to such great lengths to hide my alcoholism, both figuratively and literally. You know, literally, I hid it in the closet. I hid it in the trunk of my car. I hid it in my desk drawer. I hid it in my sock sometimes. You know, I hid it in the bushes next to the front porch in the apartment complex I used to live in. Figuratively, I hid it from everybody I could. I hid it from my girlfriend. I hid it from my parents, my coworkers. Just went to great lengths to hide my true nature. I hid it from myself. You know, I'll talk about this here in a little bit, but that first step was tough for me to get to that point where I could admit powerlessness and unmanageability. It took a lifetime of suffering and denial and deflection and juggling of lies to get there. So hid it from myself. And so for me to come in here on a Sunday night and introduce myself and say, my name is Kevin and I'm an alcoholic, it's a big deal for me. So thank you for letting me do that, enabling me to be here tonight with you all. We just read page 29. It's that's the basic format, what I'm going to try to do here. You know, I just follow the instructions, you know, tell what I was like, what happened, what I'm like now, and along the way, how I came to form a relationship with a power greater than myself. I'm in Louisville, Kentucky right now. I currently have probably 3.43 years sober. I've got an app for that. I'll tell you where I am. 3.42, 1,254 days sober today. Thank God, you know. This is definitely the longest I've ever been sober, you know, other than childhood. And speaking of, I grew up in Western Kentucky. I grew up in a small town called Sturgis. The population of Sturgis is about 1,500. The population of Sturgis at the end of the Civil War was about 1,500. Sturgis is, like so many small towns in America, a place that is slow to change. And it's a very static place. And I don't say that begrudgingly. Growing up in Sturgis was a wonderful experience for me. It's very peaceful. I felt safe growing up, you know. I did not have an unsafe childhood. I am the third son of my parents. My dad, Doug, was a farmer. He's retired now. And my mom was a homemaker. She raised us and took care of us. I have two older brothers, oldest brother Jason, the older brother Nathan. My older brother Nathan is one of us as well. And then I had a younger sister. Her name was Misha Lynn. Growing up, like so many kids with older siblings, I looked to them as my template for what was possible. And fortunately for me, I had two older brothers who did a lot of cool things and who I genuinely wanted to emulate. Like I said, you know, growing up in Sturgis, Kentucky back in the 80s was just a real peaceful experience. We were middle class. You know, my parents, they got along. My siblings and I, we all pretty much got along, and it was a good childhood. Now, there were some events in childhood that came along that I now, in hindsight, see as sort of defining, and I'll tell you a little bit about those. But for the most part, it was good. You know, growing up Sturgis was a good experience. One of the significant events was it had to do with my younger sister, Misha Lynn. I was about 3 years old, and I remember when I was I was 3 years older than her, and I remember when I was about five, we went to the doctor's office for her to get her school booster shots. And right there at the doctor's office, they gave her the shot, and she immediately had a seizure. We didn't realize the sequence of events that had been set in motion at this point. But from that day on, Misha Lynn's condition either remained static or deteriorated. Some of my earliest memories of childhood are of her, actually Christmas, which happy holidays, everybody. I can remember one Christmas, I got a little plastic hot dog stand, and I can remember my sister standing up, you know, with her hands against it, trying to do assisted walking. But after the booster shot, that went away completely. She lost her motor skills. She had been making sounds before. She lost the ability to talk. And so throughout my childhood, you know, I was always the right hand man, for helping her out, taking her to the different hospital visits, doctor's appointments. It was, in hindsight, I mean, it was a parade of disappointments, you know, going to and getting the bad news. Seizures got worse. It was just one thing after another. And, you know, she's in a wheelchair as we grew up. She was like my best friend. She was the best friend on earth too. We would just chill. I'd sit on the floor in the living room. She'd be in her wheelchair next to me. I'd be playing Nintendo. She never really said anything. She was real chill to be with. And I always felt really close to her, you know, tried to help her get along and help her do things. And, you know, it was kind of a childhood on edge in some ways. We would just be hanging out like I just described in the living room. And then you never knew when, bam, like this horrible seizure would happen. And next to then, boom, you're instantly, you drop the Nintendo controller and I got my arms around Misha, and I'm trying to calm her down and talk her down back down to earth from wherever people go when they have seizures, trying to bring her back down to earth. And, so that was a lot of what happened growing up. My oldest brother, Jason, he was 7 years old, is 7 years older than me. He was always doing much more mature stuff. My older brother, Nathan, was about 2 years older than me, so I would really watch what he was doing. One year, he entered in Union County, Kentucky, they have this contest every year at the county fair, and it's called Little Mister. And what they do is they take the children, they dress them up in a cute contest or cute costumes, and they parade them around the fairgrounds basically, and then people actually vote on who's the cutest one. And so my brother entered that, and he got like fifth place. And so I saw that and I thought, I'm cuter than him, let's do this. And so my parents, my mom helped enter me in the contest, and I went out there. The first round was like beach kid. I was beach kid in Sturgis. I had a little jam box and a towel over the other shoulder and prancing around. And then they had another one where you dressed up in, I don't know, some kind of costume. I was wearing lederhosen. But anyway, we got to the end of that and I actually won the contest. And this was like, this triggered my brain. And it actually triggered probably my first addiction, which was achievement. I liked being in the limelight and I liked having people congratulate me, tell me I was cute and all that stuff. What I didn't know at the time is that they had a state contest. So a month later, we went back to state, to the state fair, and we entered the state Little Mr. Kentucky contest. I had my partner in crime was a girl named Barbie. She was Little Miss Union County. And so they entered us in the state contest, and I can remember the interview. They asked us if we could have anything in the world, what would it be? And Barbie said, a pony. I thought that was a good answer. I told them I would like for my sister to be healed. And we won. And so that whole summer was literally one parade after another every weekend in a different county in the state of Kentucky. It was, you know, I got my first taste of fame, so to speak. I mean, I enjoyed it, going and shaking hands and meeting all these politicians and stuff like that, and going to the, throwing candy out at the parades. But there was also times where it felt kind of stressful and you get tired of the grind. I mean, we were on three different newscasts for three different local stations. It was like a big thing, and, I liked it. Honestly, I thought, man, I need more of this. I think I could get a taste of this some more. And that really helped motivate me because I beat my brother. First of all, that was like the first victory. And it made me want more achievements. And that really drove me throughout my, you know, really kind of the first half of my life. One thing about my childhood that stands out now, looking back, is that I can remember almost every night saying my prayers and praying to God. And it was like a Santa's wish list type prayer. You know, I want the Bigfoot toy. I want the He-Man playset. And I always asked God to make my sister normal. And I would wake up the next morning, go downstairs to Misha's room, and check on her, and I would see that she was not normal. And I would repeat that over and over again throughout my childhood. And so at a very early age, I began to become disillusioned with the God that I was being taught. And I grew up in the Methodist church, but my prayers were not being answered. They didn't feel like it. Now, I did get the Bigfoot toy, and I did get the He-Man playset, but my sister was still very sick, and it broke my heart. And so that's what stands out of all those prayers that were answered. It's the prayer that was unanswered. And so I carried that doubt through much of my early life, these unanswered prayers. And so, you know, I breezed through high school. You know, the whole achievement thing was, you know, was still in full effect, and I accomplished a lot of the things I wanted to accomplish. And, you know, I had good grades and all that stuff. And, I got, you know, 3 years almost into high school, before and carrying all this. I remember in fourth grade, I got a B and I was like, oh no. The nerve of Miss McKinney to give me a B, and it drove me nuts, and it never happened again until I got to college. And so I'm carrying all this, you know, I got to be the perfect kid type stuff with me, to my junior prom in high school. And that was the first time I ever got drunk. And I can remember, you know, we were at Kentucky Lake and in some house that somebody had rented for us, all dressed up. And it was my first time ever drinking. And I remember my sponsor, Don M, describes it really well, you know, but from sober to completely, you know, hugging the toilet he walked through a nice neighborhood sometime at some point through there, and I did as well. And I felt pretty much like one of the guys, and I liked it. It did feel really good. And then at some point I wrestled my date to the ground and popped an air mattress and found myself hugging the toilet. Word got back to my brother about my shenanigans, and I experienced consequences immediately. You know, a tarnished reputation, the perfect kid, tarnished now. So I really didn't drink much in high school. I didn't want to disappoint anyone. I did again my senior year at prom, but it wasn't like a big thing for me to do, which is why when I left Union County and I enrolled at Duke University in North Carolina, literally the first weekend I was there, the gloves were off. There was my brother was there, and that's the main reason I went there, because I was like, if he could get in there, I could go there. So I did. And then, you know, but he wasn't like there 24/7. And so I really started drinking in college when I got there. I went there to be a doctor, and then I almost failed out after the first semester. I'm like, well, maybe the doctor thing's not going to work out. So I went back to my passion, which was for writing. I had been a writer through middle school and high school, and I joined the student paper at Duke, and, you know, was really enjoying my work there. I was starting throughout those 4 years to experiment with outside issues. The drinking continued. While I was in college, I embarked on a very conscious and deliberate spiritual journey. I was majoring in English, but I also took enough classes to get a degree in religious studies. I still had this lingering notion of God. One of the things that really triggered it in me was I started dating a Jewish girl at the beginning of my sophomore year, and she was so devout that I couldn't help but admire it. And I wanted a taste of that, what that was like. So I went to all the stuff, the Jewish stuff with her. They have great food. I studied with a Buddhist group for a year, and that was cool. I mean, trying to sit and meditate for an hour and stuff like that. I felt really relaxed there. I studied Islam. I studied Wiccanism. I studied the Old Testament and the New Testament. I was really trying to find a higher power that I could connect with. And this is in no way a criticism of any of the religions that I studied, but it just didn't happen for me. That's just my experience. For whatever reason, it just didn't happen for me. And, you know, eventually I graduated. I got a job in San Francisco, in the height of the dot-com era. This was in 2000. This was San Francisco in the year 2000 was like a kaleidoscope of substances and alcohol and parties and money and all the things that you could possibly really want as a 22-year-old who was still very much in the research phase of what would later become alcoholism. And so I threw myself into it. My girlfriend and I broke up within a month because we had a deal that I would start going to a Jewish synagogue out there, and I just couldn't do it. I didn't do it. So we broke up, and that was a crushing blow. I did not take losing very well back then. Okay. That's just the reality. I liked being a winner. And so I took a big L on that one, and it just crushed me. And so I did the corporate communications thing for about a year, year and a half. It was great because I was writing. I really started feeling like the drinking and the other stuff was getting out of control at that time. I could tell. And, so I did what so many folks do. I decided to cure it by moving. So I moved from San Francisco back to North Carolina. I took a job with the university as the manager of the president's house. I lived with the university president and her husband. And I had the west wing of the house all to myself. And that is the place where I really started to lose my mind. You know, I wanted to write a novel. That was the goal. There's a line from the novel I wrote that said, "The house was big before we moved in, but after we did, it grew." And that's what it felt like when I got there. Like all the problems, the baggage that I had brought with me just grew and grew, and it got worse and worse. And the next thing I know, it's been a month since I've called back home. They're wondering what's going on with Kevin. You know, my boss and her husband were wondering what's going on with Kevin. The writing, I would sit at night and rewrite the same sentence over and over again. You know, I started to experience writer's block for the first time in my life. That was a loss. That felt like an L, and that hurt. And, you know, I was there for 2 years. I moved back to Louisville. I left Durham, North Carolina, like a retreating army. I mean, I'm just grabbing stuff out of the house on my way out the door, packing it into the truck. Get me the heck out of here, you know? And so I came back to Louisville. I wanted to be closer to my family. At the time, my sister's condition had worsened significantly. And then she was about 23 years old, and they had put her on a ventilator at home. And my parents were taking care of her almost constantly. And I felt like we were getting close to the end. So I wanted to get closer to home. I also needed to get out of Durham. And the stuff that I was doing in Durham was the same stuff that I found when I got back to Louisville. Just the same mess, different place. Took a job at Starbucks. That whole period of my life is kind of a blur, honestly. I ended up moving back home to Sturgis, back to square one. 26 years old at the time, moved in with my parents, and, you know, Misha's ventilator would make these sounds all night long, and it would drive my parents nuts, and it would wake me up, and I was upstairs in the madness, y'all, and I felt like the lowest form of life. Because my parents are down there worried about my sister, but the reality is I had become the new patient. I had become the new source of worry in the family, not Misha. Misha's destiny was becoming clearer and clearer. Mine, I mean, it was a mess. And so I remember one time Misha was in the hospital in Evansville, Indiana. I had gone home, and one way or another, my uncle and my aunt came to the house. They found me passed out in the bathroom. The door was wide open. A fresh pizza was sitting on the table. And it's like, Kevin's got a problem, you know. Took me about a month from that experience, though. I mean, I deflected. But about a month later, I almost died. And I went to the hospital. I said, "Mom, Dad, I need help. I don't know what to do. Please help." Few phone calls later, I was on February 4th, 2007, I was at a treatment center here in Louisville, Kentucky. And I remember going to my first AA meeting and just thinking, my goodness, how did I get here? That's what had happened in the years that led up to that, is I had stopped asking God. I still had this lingering notion of God. But I had stopped asking God, why are you doing this to my sister and my family? And it became personal. Why are you doing this to me? What kind of God would do this to a guy like me? I'm a pretty nice guy, you know. And I had just really stopped believing, stopped even trying over those few years leading up to 2007. So God was off the table when I went to treatment, and I'd go to these meetings and I'd hear them talking about God, and I'd be like, how did I get here? Like, look at these people. This is me. I mean, my warped brain's looking around the room saying, man, I'm better than these people. Come on, man. This is ridiculous. But the reality is I was right where I belonged. I was right where I needed to be. And I was in treatment for a couple months. I moved back to Sturgis for a month or two. I ended up getting my own place. I was really enjoying sobriety. I was going to a ton of meetings. I had a sponsor. Just taking the substances and the alcohol away, just that move right there had really given me a new, I mean, I felt like I was alive again and I was in the game. And so, you know, I started meeting with my sponsor. We sat down and worked through, you know, talked about the first step, and yep, that was obvious. We got to the second step, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And at this point, the God question was a binary proposition to me, completely binary. There was no gray area. There either was a God or there was not a God. And because, or I either believed in God or I didn't believe in God. And because I didn't believe in God, I can't do this step. And so my step work stopped on step two, right then and right there. Now, my life didn't fall apart because I didn't do my step work. In fact, it got better. I ended up, like I said, getting my own place in Henderson. I got a job in journalism. Had a short relapse, about 9 months sober. I got back on the horse, you know, and I'm all right. They took me to treatment. And I stayed one day and I was like, I know what to do. I got it figured out. It's all good. I'm out. And I left and I went back to my life, and I ended up putting together about 3 years after that, 3 years just on meetings and no step work. Now, I do not recommend this path, but this is my this is what happened. This is my story. I'm glad I was sober. I felt good. I played video games all the time. I didn't have much of a social life. I was working nights at the newspaper. And things got better. I remember on May 25th, 2008, a couple days before that, I got a call from my parents, that Misha, had been in the hospital in Louisville. She was in the children's hospital. She was 27 years old, but they still treated her like a child. I'll say this about her. She taught me so much. She was the closest thing to an angel on earth that I've ever met. She never had the opportunity to sin. She never voiced a foul word toward anyone. She meant the world to me. She was my best friend. So when we got the call that it was time to take her off life support, drove to Louisville, big family meeting at the hospital. My mother and I were the last two holdouts. And then we just made the decision. And so on May 25th, we all gathered at the hospital. We got there around 9 or 10 o'clock. And I can remember that day so crystal clear. And I'm so glad I was sober for it, because that's how I'm able to remember it so crystal clear. And I can remember that we had my brother, both of my brothers, my sister-in-law, my mom and my dad. They had given us this, it's called a bariatric bed. It's an extra wide bed. And we were all in bed with her. And they turned the machines off. And they told us it'd take about an hour. And the hour goes by. And then 2 hours go by. And man, she's kind of hanging on. 3 hours go by. I can remember it was a Sunday. And the sun was shining through the windows at the hospital. And I don't know why or how, but it was reflecting small prisms all over the room, little rainbows everywhere. And I can remember we had instrumental music playing, as we eased her out of this life. And there was a guitar version of Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And at 3:55 p.m., she left this life. And we were all there together. And I can remember feeling something that day that I could not describe. I can feel it right now, telling you all about it. It was the presence of God in the room. And I was not willing to call it what it was. But man, I felt it. Earlier tonight, I asked Billy if I should wear a tie. And he told me Dawn did, so I put one on. When I went and picked out a tie, I picked this one out because this is the tie I picked out to wear to her funeral. I wore this to my sister's funeral, and whenever I only wear this to significant events in my life now, and I can feel her presence right here, right now, you know. So that, we went on from that moment. And that moment carried me for years in sobriety, quite honestly. And I decided, here I go again. I wanted more from my life. The job in journalism just wasn't cutting it. I felt like I was on the sidelines. I wanted to get a little more involved in the action. In 2010, I studied for the LSAT, took it, did well enough to get, you know, admitted into University of Louisville Law School. Man, I felt like a fish out of water. I was in my like early 30s. All these kids around me were like 22, 23 years old. That I started trying to fit in. I started to feel those same insecurities I felt so much growing up, that apartness we all talk about, feel. I made it about 2 months. People knew I was sober. I made it about 2 months into late October when I was at a party in law school. And I said, hey, pass me that. And they looked at me and they're like, you know what's in this, right? And I said, I know exactly what's in that. Pass me that. The pressure of trying to fit in. Law school itself can be stressful. I was not spiritually fit for law school. And sure enough, I relapsed. And that relapse, you know, relapse, you hear it said, relapse is part of recovery. You know, when people go back out, I'm so glad when they make it back, because I almost didn't make it back. And my relapse lasted for 7 years. Seven horrible, just years of torture. And it didn't just boom, take off from the jump. It was glacial at first, just gradual. And then it unlocks that phenomenon of craving. It's right there. And I'm thinking about it when I don't have it. And then I want it. And suddenly I'm back in it, man. Just back in the madness. And this time around, the main attraction was alcohol. And, you know, it's funny. I used to go to another fellowship way back in the day, and I would look in at the people in the AA meeting, and I would just feel sorry for them for getting licked by alcohol. It just seemed like such a lesser drug to me. It took me getting my butt completely kicked for 7 years by alcohol for me to realize what was really going on. And they had given me a big book way back when, but I had never even opened it because that was not my issue. And so I finished law school. I got a job as a public defender. All of a sudden, you know, it just, the stress just keeps amping up. All the more reason to drink. They're throwing serious cases at me, murder cases, stuff like that. I'm doing my best, but every night when I'm getting home, man, smash city, just oblivion. And in 2004, I met my girlfriend, Amy. I moved in with her a year later. That was a mistake. I was in no way fit to be living with anybody, but we did it anyway. And that's where what I talked about at the beginning really becomes like just a total way of life, hiding it, just hiding it constantly, constantly hiding it and juggling the lies. Just, oh, the house of cards I had built. I left the public defender's office. I went into private practice, which was great. That gave me more time to drink, gave me more freedom. And I took advantage of that, and it just got worse and worse and worse. And I can remember not wanting to go to any AA meetings because my ego was just afraid I would run into a client who had been court ordered to go there in one of my cases. And I could not accept that. So it just got worse and worse, and it got to the point where this is a progressive disease. We just get to the point where it is everything. And it's awful, and it's my favorite thing on earth, and the thing that's killing me. And, you know, I got to the point where I couldn't go more than an hour without a drink before the shakes would set in, before the thing that happens in the brain coming off of alcohol. I can't even describe it. It's like anxiety on crack or something. I mean, it's just like off the chain, and I'd feel that. And finally, just a moment, I tried a detox at the apartment with Amy one time. That was like peeling the skin right off of my body, hallucinating. I did it for a few days. I went back to it, you know, and eventually I just had this moment. It was just like 2007 all over again, where I said, Mom, Dad, I can't stop. I need help. So I detoxed in a hotel room with my parents, and I shopped for a treatment center. I wanted a place that was really kind of a vacation destination, you know, something I found, you know, something that had horseback riding and trails and hiking. And I was looking to kind of double dip here and, you know, get sober, but also have a vacation. It had been years. I deserved a vacation. So I found this place called The Ranch in Nunley, Tennessee, and I went there I got there and they stuck me in a detox ward, and it was a hospital setting. And I was like, man, this isn't like on the website. I felt kind of duped, but eventually they moved me into a house with some guys. And I had this RA there. This was July 23rd, 2017. Okay. A couple of days after that, they gave me a big book, and I actually started reading it. And instantly I had never felt so connected with a written anything in my entire life. I felt like it was written just for me. You know, it was written just for me. And I dove into it headlong. Here's the thing. Don and I talk, my sponsor Don, and we talk about this, how, you know, the obsessiveness that can drive us, you know, to near death can also become our ally when we channel it in the right direction. So that same achievement addiction that I had grown up with, suddenly I turned that on my sobriety, and I wanted to be the soberest person in the room. Man, I wanted to be, put me in, coach. I want to win the dunk contest at the All-Star weekend. I want to be on the All-Star team and be MVP. And so I went hard at AA, and I had this RA who was great. He was a disciplinarian. He was a former Marine. And he started telling me what to do. One of the things he told me to do was make my bed every morning. And I didn't really understand why, but I did it. Another thing, I'll tell you this too. I currently have a 1,254-day bed-making streak going. Because that little thing at the beginning of the day is just one tiny little way that I can restore a little bit of order and get a win early in the day. So I still do that. The other thing he told me to do was get down on my knees and pray. Now, I did not know how to pray. There was so much distance between the last time I had prayed and that moment that I just sat there on my knees and I read 86 through 88 of the big book. I still have the bookmark here. The Prayer of St. Francis, they gave me that. 12-step principles, 416 through 420. I just would read. And then slowly that became something else. That became prayer. One of the things I noticed real early on is that every time I prayed, I felt just a little bit better when I was done. That wasn't always, so I had some really good, some prayers that where I came away feeling drastically improved. But at that time, at that low point in my life, where my life was rubble, I needed a small victory. And every time I prayed, I got that. And that kept me coming back. I'm an addict. I'm an alcoholic. If you give me a little bump of something good, I'm going to want more of it. And that's what it came for me with prayer. So all of a sudden I'm praying every morning, every night, in the middle of the day. You know, that guy looked at me wrong. I'll pray about it, you know. And magically, it started to feel better. Now, I still have the step work I did in treatment. And it was like, yeah, I don't know about the God thing. Maybe I could look into it, that sort of thing. I still felt stuck. Now, when I was getting ready to leave, the RA said, you're a lawyer in Louisville, right? I said, yeah. He said, all right. I know a guy who's in Louisville, and he's a lawyer, and he's in AA. And I'm going to get, his name's Don M. Have you heard of Don M? I was like, no, I've never heard of Don M. He said, I'm going to give you his number, and I'm going to give you this piece of advice. If I were you, when I got back to Louisville, I would get in his back pocket. So I got back to Louisville, and I put the piece of paper in my pocket. I'd been back for about 4 days, the mess I had left behind was still there, y'all. The whole vacation I'd taken, you know, I came back to a completely broken relationship with Amy. My parents were like, what happened to Kev? You know, surprise. They thought I was sober the whole time, the whole 7 years, by the way. And at work, you know, the partners at the law firm where I was, man, they were mad. And clients I hadn't called for months, whoo, they were angry. So I came back and I was pacing around in my office one afternoon. I felt like my whole body was going to explode from the anxiety and just cover the walls. And then I remembered I had the phone number in my pocket. I pulled it out and I called Don in. And I got his voicemail. And it was something to the effect of, Don, you don't know me. It was frantic. I'm saying it real cool now, but it was, Don, you don't know me. I don't know you. I'm a lawyer. I'm in Louisville. I got your name in treatment, blah, 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 blah. One of the things I learned in treatment was that I didn't know when to ask for help, and I'm asking you for help, Don. Please call me. I need help. Left the voicemail, and I was on my way to a meeting about 2 hours later, and the phone rang, and it was Don. And I pulled into the parking lot at that meeting, but I never went to that meeting. Because I sat out in my car and talked to him for an hour. And that was the beginning of a relationship that has absolutely changed and saved my life. From the beginning, Don, you know, he really immediately plugged me into what AA was all about. You know, invited me to his house for the meeting, which Billy was talking about. I chair that meeting now on Monday nights. It's an honor. Just to be in that room. And so we started doing the step work. And I remember telling him about my experience in 2007. He looked at me and said, Kev, I don't think you've ever really been in recovery. And all that was like, hey, might as well just stab me in the heart. I was like, Don, I had 3 years, man. What are you talking about? He's like, no, I mean, step work, the program. So, man, we launched into it, you know, and he, at the time, we weren't Zooming back then. I mean, he would drive to go speak at all these different places, and I'd drive him or I'd ride along with him, and we would just talk. And we have a special relationship. I'm so grateful for him. We got to the second step, and I had told him all about how I just never got past that step. And he said, well, Kevin, what's the word? What are the words on the page? And I said, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. He said, read it again. I said, came to believe. He said, stop. What does that say? I said, came to believe. He said, Kevin, you're a lawyer. You're supposed to know words. You're supposed to be good with words. Look at the words on the page. Came to believe. That denotes a process. I said, oh, so I don't have to believe? He said, no. We come to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. I said, well, how do we do that? He said, you have got to conduct yourself as if you believe. You have got to behave in a manner that is consistent with belief. I said, well, how do I do that? And so we start talking about living the AA way of life, prayer, meditation, you know, the principles, spiritual principles of honesty, you know, kindness, compassion. You know, I just kept praying every morning. I kept doing my morning readings. There were so many foxhole prayers too along the way. It's not like my life just came together and got better overnight. I was eventually let go from the law firm where I was working. And, man, that was a crushing blow. I thought, wow, I don't know what I'm going to do now. But by then, at that point, you know, I was coming to believe. And I can't, like, tell you, it's not on my calendar exactly when that happened. But at some point, it did. And it's changed everything for me. It has given me the answers to the questions that had vexed me my entire life. It's helped me make sense of the things that I never could understand on my own. All the things that had happened to me in my life and to my family had all happened for a reason that I did not understand at the time, or I didn't want to see, or I was unwilling to grasp. And it's all happened according to God's plan, not Kevin's. And so that's what's happened for me, is that the understanding we talk about it in the big book. We had a new employer. Thank God I have been fired as the manager of my life, because I sucked at it. I was horrible at it. And so now this is God's world, not mine. And so the things that are happening in God's world, not Kevin. And I have a chance at having a good day if I can just relax and let go of the things that are beyond my reasoning and control and just try to do the next right thing. You know, Don describes it real well. He says, and I don't know if he came up with this. I think his sponsor told him this. He says, when he's running on self-will, he's like the ant on the log floating down a river thinking he's steering the log. You know, but when he's in God's will, he's just the ant doing the tiny little ant thing that's in front of him. And so I started doing that stuff. I did. I relaxed and my life got better. I had this feeling that some greater, higher power was in charge and not me. And so another thing that Don told me early on, I said, I was complaining to him. I couldn't make it to enough meetings. I was too busy. He said, Kevin, you're right, man. You're just too busy for this thing. I said, what? He said, yep, you're never going to fit AA into your life. You've got to fit your life into AA. I didn't know what he meant, but I learned. And that means every phone call, every interaction, the cashier at the grocery store, you know, the phone call with your parents 5 minutes before you're going to give an AA talk, every interaction is an opportunity to practice this program. My sobriety, my recovery is built on little things like making the bed. Little things like when I get home from the grocery store, I put the groceries up immediately. When I do the laundry, I fold it immediately. When I get a phone call, I try to take it. You know, all these little things that seem insignificant at the time, but add up to something great. And so what has happened to me is I've been able to, I've got the best girlfriend on earth. We've been together 6.5 years now. We live together here at the house. I'm in our basement right now. Thanks to this program and her extreme willingness, we've been able to rebuild that relationship into something newer and better than ever before. Grateful to God for her. Getting let go from the law firm gave me an opportunity to start my own business. And so I started my own private practice, Pride Law Office here in Louisville, Kentucky. And I wrote it from the ground up. The business plan is based on AA principles. So everything I do at work now is an illustration and an opportunity for me to practice this program. What I'm talking about, every phone call. The idea is to just to help people, you know. And so my life, I have very consciously tried to fit my life into AA. And that means when somebody calls and they need help, try to answer the call. You know, I sponsor 4 guys now. You know, I try to make it to as many meetings as I can. It's honestly, it's not as many as when I first came back around. But I've worked the steps. I don't have enough time to go through all that. But man, Don can take you through the steps. I've learned so much, and Don has the best gift from all that is learning how to take somebody else through the steps, because that is the juice of this program I've learned. It really is. You know, I'm going to go ahead and wrap up because my timer went off, but I just want to thank you all so much for just letting me run my mouth for a little while. And let me join you all here. This moment right now, what we're doing is a miracle. When you look at, one of the things Don and I ascribe to is the no big deals philosophy. And that means, you know, maintaining the perspective on things. And, you know, everything that happened in my life, everything that happened in the life of every square on my screen right now had to happen to bring us here right now in an AA meeting, totally in the game here. You know, I just want to be in the game anymore. I don't want to be the superstar all-star. You know, I might dribble the ball off my foot. I might miss a layup. It's all good because I'm in the game. I'm alive. We're all still alive despite everything. And sitting here spending time talking about God and recovery, it just blows my mind, you all. This is an amazing program. I thank God for all of you right now and for my life, my sobriety. My name's Kevin. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks for letting me share.